Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Are we in full control of our good habits and at the mercy of our bad ones? And what makes our harmful or unproductive routines so hard to reset? My guest today began his investigation into these questions simply wondering about the time it takes to make or break a habit, and ended up scouring years of scientific research into the mechanisms by which our actions become automatic. It turns out we do, in fact, have the power to control these behaviors, but that a lot of the conventional wisdom about how to do it may be steering us wrong. Jeremy Dean is a psychologist and creator of the website SciBlog. His new book is called Making Habits, Breaking Habits: Why We Do Things, Why We Don't, and How to Make Any Change Stick. Jeremy, welcome to Think.
Hi, Chris. Thank you for having me on.
From a scientific perspective, what exactly is a habit?
Oh, a habit, I suppose, is anything that you do regularly in the same situation. So brushing your teeth in the morning or looking both ways before you cross the road are all kind of good habits, and I think a lot of our habits are very good ones.
And we don't really think about a lot of the, well, we don't think about our habits. What is the sort of evolutionary advantage of our tendency to do so many things on autopilot?
Well, despite the fact that our brains are so huge relative, you know, to a lot of other animals, and we have all this cognitive capacity, we have all this ability and talent, you know, as human beings, still, our attention is relatively narrow. We can only concentrate on a certain number of things at any one time. So one of the things that habits are doing for us is they're allowing us to do loads of stuff automatically, and it's freeing us up for loads of other kind of more interesting things sometimes.
So in other words, I don't have to think about the way I drive home, so I can think about what happened during the workday, that sort of thing.
Exactly, and yeah, I mean, I've certainly had that experience, and I'm sure lots of other people have, of especially going to work in the morning, maybe with not quite enough sleep, and then arriving at the office and wondering exactly how you managed to get there. Mm-hmm. Certainly I've had that, and you're sitting at the desk going, wow, you know, I suppose I must have looked at the traffic lights, and I must have eaten my breakfast, but I don't really very clearly remember it.
So how do repetition and reinforcement play into the habits we've all developed without even really thinking about them?
Yeah, I think that quite often our habits do follow on from our intentions. I suppose the vast majority of our habits are as a result of things that perhaps we started doing when we were children, and which kind of are heading towards goals that we want to achieve, and repetition is really important with how habits build up. When they're studied, they find that there's a kind of you have to sort of go up this hill, and each time that you repeat something, it gets a little bit more automatic. And by automatic, I mean that you don't have to have a sort of tussle with your willpower over it. It's just something that you naturally do, you know, without really necessarily thinking about it that much. Mm-hmm. So repetition is really important in how habits form.
And as you mentioned earlier, the good news is that our good habits, or at least our neutral habits, tend to, for most of us, probably outweigh our bad ones.
Yeah, I think they do, really. But we don't tend to think too much about our good habits. It's really the bad ones, or rather the results of the bad ones, that we tend to focus on. And when people are asked in studies, you know, about how do you feel about your habits, people kind of disown them and say, you know, my habits don't define me. I don't feel any particular sense of pride about my habits. Whereas I think often people should, because, you know, a lot of our habits are keeping us healthy and on time and clean and all those other kinds of things. So they're doing a lot of good stuff for us.
On the other hand, the comforting belief that if we can just stick it out for 21 days, we can consider a good habit set or a bad one broken, turns out, as you discovered, not to have a lot of solid scientific evidence in its favor.
No, exactly. And this is one of the things that started me off on the book. And I'd come across this number, 21 days or possibly even 28 days at the outside, as being how long it takes to form a habit. And because I'm a research psychologist, I wanted to see, you know, what kind of research this is based on. And it turns out to be very flimsy. And it's really based on people repeating it over the years, and also it being kind of a convenient number, I think, for self-help authors to quote. But there has actually been some research done a couple of years ago at University College London, and they got people to ingrain relatively regular habits, things like basic exercise habits and even simple things like drinking a glass of water after breakfast. And they found that that person drinking the glass of water after breakfast had ingrained the habit after 3 weeks, I think it was. Mm-hmm. And there was someone else in the study trying to do some sit-ups. And it had taken him, I think his habit wasn't even formed after 3 months. So you're going to have this huge variation, I think. And it depends on the habit that you're trying to ingrain and the habits that you already have and your personality as well is going to have a difference.
Let's talk about that, the habits you already have, because it turns out that one really good way to create a new habit is to take one we already have that we can do without and switch the two, one for each other, so that you're using the same cues to turn you on to the behavior that you actually want to do.
Yeah, absolutely. And this is more thinking about how to break a habit, really, mm-hmm. because this is when people will generally use it. There'll be some response to a particular situation that they're not happy with. And one example might be something like feeling anxious and biting your nails, for example. And so what you're looking to do is to try to create a different response to that same cue, because you know you're going to get anxious at some point and you're going to get stressed. So you want to have a different type of response. So it might be take out your nail clippers and clip your nails, keep them nice and tidy, or it might be to put your hands in your pockets where you can't, bite on them quite so easily. So, yeah, this kind of idea of replacing the bad habit with a good one is really important in breaking bad habits.
And one thing that sounds really obvious but matters is you have to want it. I don't bite my nails, but I have a habit of popping my fingernail, my finger joints, cracking my knuckles.
Yes.
And honestly, it maybe bothers other people, but it's never really bothered me, and so I've never shaken it. It's been more than 30 years that I've been doing this.
I've heard this from sort of both sides.
Uh-huh.
And I've heard people say, how do you stop other people cracking their nails? It's really irritating. And, it doesn't bother me at all. And motivation, yeah, is so important. And when you're trying to change yourself, you know, it's difficult enough. And then if you're trying to change other people, it's almost impossible. But, so motivation is going to be really important in changing any of these kinds of habits.
Do we respond better or worse to positive versus negative motivation? In other words, are we more apt to change a habit if there's a reward at the end than if there's a punishment for failing?
I think that it'll depend, but certainly what's been found in studies for increasing your motivation, kind of thinking about both sides of it is really important. So you're looking to sort of try and pull yourself towards new habits and push yourself away from those bad old habits at the same time. So certainly thinking about the things that are attracting you to your new replacement habit is really good, and focusing on the fact, you know, the things that are trying to push you away from your old bad habit can create that sort of tension that will help push you towards the new routine that you're looking for.
I was interested that one mistake that we tend to make when we think about self-improvement is taking on too much at once or failing to be really specific. So in other words, if we decide we want to get in shape this season or get organized or whatever, how do we go about meeting such a goal?
Yeah, this comes up quite a lot, doesn't it? Especially with New Year's resolutions. And people tend to make quite vague New Year's resolutions, things like, yeah, I want to be healthier, or even more vaguely, I want to be a better person in the 2013. And now, what does that mean? You know, what does it mean being a better person? And it's much better to make these really specific plans. And psychologists have tested these over the years, and there's sort of decades of research now, and thousands of people have been through these studies, and these special types of plans, which are called if-then plans, seem to work very well. And the idea is that you connect together a situation with an action using if and then. So, for example, with healthy eating, you might say to yourself, if I feel hungry between meals, then I will eat an apple. So that's really strong connection between the situation that you're going to be in feeling hungry and the action that you're going to take. So it's like what you're doing with this if-then plan is you're sort of setting up a blueprint for your unconscious. You're saying to your unconscious, this is the way I want to behave automatically in the future.
And I guess it also helps to anticipate in the at the same time you're anticipating the things that might trip you up. If you say you're going to eat healthy and then you're starving, if you haven't thought about how you're going to handle being very, very hungry, you might jump into a pile of junk food.
Exactly. And this, psychologists call there's something called the planning fallacy. And this, everyone will have experienced this. Someone says to you, how long will it take you to, for example, you know, write this report? And you say, oh, I'll have that done by Friday, that's no problem. And because you don't anticipate all the obstacles that you're going to face, you know, you don't realize that you're going to get called all the time and you're going to have loads of other stuff to do. And so there's this fallacy arises. The same kind of thing goes on when you're planning to change your habits. You know, it seems in the sort of, you know, that kind of rose-tinted spectacles, you think, I should be able to do this, no problem. But in the cold light of day, suddenly, you know, you notice that there are actually all these obstacles to going to the gym and or changing the things that you eat or whatever else, you know, whatever other habits you're wanting to change. So, yeah, thinking about the ways, the things that are going to stop you performing a habit is really important.
How does either positive or negative thinking affect our ability to change a habit one way or another?
Yeah, visualization. Yeah, the thing we talked about earlier, visualization is really important in making it really in kind of making the difference between the positive and negative aspects as strong as you possibly can. And there's this task that you can do, which is called mental contrasting, and it's really listing the pros and the cons, I guess. And people seem to quite like listing all the positive aspects of a habit that they want to change or ingrain, but aren't quite so keen on thinking about the obstacles, as we were talking about. But it seems to be really important to think about these negative aspects and then do this contrasting, so kind of put them together. And what psychologists have found in studies is that this will either put you off if you don't expect to succeed, or if you do expect to succeed, then it'll give you that extra push of motivation and it'll make you feel more energized towards the goal that you're going for. So this mental contrasting technique seems to work quite well.
So perhaps no one can stop me from cracking my knuckles or stop someone else from biting their nails, but what do we have the power to help someone who does want our help in changing a habit, and what are the best ways to support somebody who's going through this?
Yeah, definitely there are. Yeah, if someone does want to change, then it's great to be able to support them in some way. And one of the best things you can do is based really on one of the fundamental things about a habit, which is that it tends to operate unconsciously in response to particular situations. So when you tend to take the same kind of actions in the same kind of situations, but often you don't realize exactly how you're performing things. So what you can do if someone else is trying to make a change, is you can just point out to them, gently, hopefully, that they're performing this particular habit at a particular time. And then once the person realizes, you know, there's a connection between the situation and the action, then you've got that first kind of clue of how you can go about making a change. So, yeah, that's really important to sort of awareness, I think, self-awareness, and giving that awareness to someone else can be very helpful.
My guest is psychologist Jeremy Dean. He's the creator of SciBlog and author of the new book, Making Habits, Breaking Habits, Why We Do Things, Why We Don't, and How to Make Any Change Stick. If you'd like to join the conversation to ask a question or maybe tell a story of how you dealt with a habit that you either wanted or didn't want, give us a call. The number is 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. New spring semester personal enrichment and professional development courses are now open and available for registration. You can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is psychologist Jeremy Dean. He is the creator of SciBlog and author of the new book, Making Habits, Breaking Habits, Why We Do Things, Why We Don't, and How to Make Any Change Stick. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Why does it not work, Jeremy, to simply put out of our mind doing something that we want to break the habit of doing?
This seems to be quite an intuitive way of approaching a habit change, which is to try and push it out of your mind. You know, you're trying to eat more healthily, so you think, well, if I don't think about cake all day long, then surely I'll be fine. And unfortunately, it doesn't work. It's one of those irritating things about the way the brain works, is that there's this theory in psychology called ironic processes theory, and it really is a very ironic process. It's like if I say to you, don't think about a pink elephant, and then it's the very first thing that comes to your mind. Mm-hmm. And when they do these studies with people, and in fact it's a white bear quite often that they use in these studies, this white bear comes back, you know, and people in the studies have to ring a little bell every time they think about a white bear when they're not supposed to be. And, they're sitting there ringing this bell continuously. So the same is true with habits as well. And, you know, if you try to push a thought out of your mind or a habit or something that you're trying to avoid, you know, if you're trying to push it down, it comes back stronger. And we see this with people who are, for example, trying to eat healthily. Quite often it can actually lead to binge eating. And the same with drinking as well, that if you're trying to cut down your alcohol, sometimes the more you try not to think about wine, the more it seems to be everywhere. So once again, it's about trying to replace, and replace seems to work much better than suppress.
A few years ago, the essayist David Sedaris was trying to quit smoking and recognized that his home environment was full of cues that triggered his desire for nicotine. And so he and his partner moved for some time to Japan. And I wonder if that sort of, not all of us can afford to do that, but if that sort of major change from our normal environment is in fact helpful in breaking a habit.
Oddly, someone told me a very similar story about moving to Japan and losing a lot of weight just the other day. And it must be something about Japan, but it's terribly healthy there. Perhaps we should all move there. But it is. It's related to the situation and the cues, exactly. So our environments tend to automatically cue off these behaviors. And so one way, yeah, is of changing all your habits is to move somewhere completely different. And I suppose you see this, most of us see this strongly when we go on holiday, and certainly I do as a confirmed tea-drinking regular English person. When I go away on holiday, of course, I can't get tea just the way I like it, so I end up drinking coffee. But as soon as I come back home, then I start drinking tea again, and the coffee's forgotten. Hmm. And it's just one sort of example. But these go on and on. But the question becomes, I suppose, if you can't afford to move to Japan to change, you know, your tea drinking habit, and probably that won't help if you move to Japan because they're pretty hot on their tea as well, aren't they? So if you can't afford to sort of, you know, change your situation that radically, then what can you do instead? I suppose, and there are actually smaller tweaks that you can make to your environment. But the overall message is, you know, that our situations do cue off our habits, and so they have a huge effect on the way the routine activities we perform.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now and speak with Kelly in LaDonia. Hi, Kelly.
Hi. Thanks, Chris. Hey, over the years, I feel like I've observed, it could be completely wrong, that my children form habits, bad habits, during periods of stress. So say there's one laying there feeling sick, doesn't feel good, and maybe starts whining. And, you know, I want to take care of the child, and, oh, sure, I'll do whatever you want, when normally I wouldn't listen to whining. And then after the child's feeling better, the whining continues. So that's been my observation, and trying to combat that. By the time I got to my third child, I was a bit hardened to that sickly whining and didn't have so much trouble with it.
Yeah, what about that? Thanks for your call, Kelly. What about, Jeremy, are we more likely to fall into bad habits when things are not going well for us?
I think they can. And I think with children especially, sometimes are very difficult to reason with. And it can be difficult. They know that if they keep complaining, then they can get what they want, especially perhaps if they're in public. And, you know, parents will be doing everything to get them to be quiet, and quite often will be, you know, you have that temptation to bribe them to keep quiet. And there's quite a bit of research showing that sort of this idea of bribing children to keep them quiet isn't a good thing, because they get used to getting that reward all the time. But sometimes it does have to be done, I think, in emergency situations.
We have an email here from William in Euless who says, I'd love to hear your thoughts on the similarities and differences between habits and addictions.
Yeah, well, the classic example with this is smoking, actually. And if you think about nicotine as what we generally think of as addiction, you know, that you're addicted to nicotine. But there's also a whole other side to smoking, which is related to habits. And so people like to, for example, smoke a cigarette with friends or with a cup of coffee or in response to a particular situation. And we call that habit. But really, you know, there's a lot of bleed-through between the two. And I think a lot of what we call addiction is partly habitual. And I've heard people say that when they're giving up smoking, that sometimes it's the sort of habitual aspects of it rather than the addictive aspects of nicotine that can be most difficult. You know, people say, well, I don't know what to do with my hands now. And, you know, and I need to, when I'm talking to people, I'm smoking. So it's kind of replacing that that habit that can be very difficult.
What sort of role does willpower play in habits?
I think we've got this. We've certainly got this idea over the years, haven't we? That that if we want to change ourselves, then it's a matter of willpower. And if you fail to change yourself, then your willpower is weak. That's how the logic used to go. But I think now we're starting to realise, with this research that's coming out on willpower, showing that it's a limited resource. You know, we only have so much of it, and it, as we get stressed and distracted, it tends to wear down over the day. And so, you know, we're looking now for new ways of affecting change in ourselves. And I think habits offer one way of sidestepping willpower in the long term, because you're looking for that unconscious automatic response that's kind of bypassing the conscious parts of your mind. And you're looking to ingrain these automatic behaviors that are going to bypass willpower. Of course, the problem always with habits is getting them going in the first place. And when you're first trying to get a habit going, of course, you have to a certain extent, rely on willpower. So willpower will always be important in this way.
One thing that seems to really stop people in their tracks is they're going along really well. They're having some success with changing a habit, either forming a good one or eliminating a bad one, and then they backslide. And then, do you have to sort of start over, or does the progress of the past weeks or months or whatever it is count for something?
Yeah, I mean, it certainly does. And I think this is one of the things that came up when I was first researching habits. And it came up with this 21 or 28 days to form a habit number. The other thing that came along was you must not break the chain. You know, you must perform your habit every day for 21 days. And that turns out not to be true either. In that research I mentioned earlier, which found this huge variation but in the amount of time it took to form habits, sometimes people did miss out a day or two, and it didn't seem to have too much of an effect on the formation of the habit. I mean, I don't think you really go backwards. It's just that, you know, you don't go any further forwards. So you're looking to, you know, kind of be kind to yourself and really develop some self-compassion with forming new habits, because it's going to be difficult. And there is this research now coming out showing that self-compassion can be really useful and can actually motivate you in comparison to sort of being tough on yourself, which is perhaps how we've come to think of the right method of ingraining a habit, to sort of be really tough. But that, I don't think that's quite so good, and it's all right to forgive yourself for these lapses, which are bound to happen.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We have David on the line now in Dallas. Hi, David.
Good afternoon. I have a question. You address willpower and the desire and habits and addictions. And my life is a prime example of that. I went to school in London and picked up a bad scotch drinking habit during university. And I drank heavily every day. I never drank during work hours. I always wait till 5 p.m. And I would polish off a 750-milliliter bottle of scotch virtually every day. May 20th, 2011, I decided I was tired of it. Have not touched any alcohol since for a year and three quarters. I can be around people that drink. I can smell it. It's in my house. My wife drinks it. Even my kids drink it. And I love wine. I love beer. And I love scotch. But I just made them to change my pattern that day on the 20th. And I haven't gone back since, and it doesn't bother me at all. So if willpower is limited and it wears down each and every day, how can someone do that?
David, thanks for your call. Jeremy, were you able to hear and understand that? The line was a little fuzzy.
Yeah, I got that, yeah. And I hear these stories from time to time that people say, look, you know, I just stopped smoking or I just stopped drinking on this particular day and that's it. I haven't had, you know, I haven't really had any more cravings for it. And that's great. That's absolutely fantastic. And that's a really nice story to hear. Unfortunately, the story I hear more often, especially from people who've been addicted to alcohol or who've drunk quite a lot of alcohol, and I'm not saying the caller was addicted to alcohol, but, you know, for people who have a serious addiction, they do quite often say that even though, for example, they haven't drunk for 10 years or 20 years, that they still think of themselves as an alcoholic, and they will be for the rest of their lives. And part of the reason for that is that habits seem to lie in the unconscious, really, for the rest of our lives. And those habits are kind of are always there waiting to be reactivated. And so people who have these kinds of habits do have to be continuously vigilant in some ways. Although it's great to hear that the caller had success with making that change. It's fantastic.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also email think@kera.org. Steve writes, what is the mechanism by which one can attempt to stop a habit like smoking many times, and it said that each time will be easier?
Yeah, and I suppose this is the other side to what the caller was saying. You know, instead of stopping all at once, you know, it's kind of about, you know, you're trying to knock over or push over quite a heavy object, and you have to kind of rock it backwards and forwards a few times until it goes all the way. And I think this is perhaps more the more normal or the more frequent attitude to changing your habits. And I think that's certainly the case often with smokers who do tend to give up quite a lot before they finally really give up. So that, I think that seems to be quite a frequent experience.
One habit that it seems many, many of us have fallen into and would like to change is spending more time than is good for us online. Can you talk a little bit about how this sort of emerged as a global, maybe not a bad habit, but a global habit that uses up a lot of our time? And what is so compelling about staying online when we have other things to do?
Well, this is one of the things that's particularly interesting to me, as I have quite a bad email habit, which I've been struggling with over the years. And I was interested in looking at this research because the internet is so ubiquitous nowadays, isn't it? From the moment that you wake up in the morning and you've got your smartphone by the bed, and then you get into the office computer's connected to the internet, and then you get back at home and you've got a tablet maybe, and your TV's connected to the internet. So all these kind of online habits are really easy to perform, and these devices are designed to react attractively and beautifully to the things that we do, the things, you know, when we touch them. So it's really easy to pick up these habits, and they're quite often, I think, they're displacement activities, aren't they? Certainly they are for me when I'm sitting in front of the computer and I'm supposed to be doing some proper work. And I think, well, I'll just check my email, or, you know, I'll just have a quick look on Facebook. Mm-hmm. And you know, that's fine, but they can get out of control, these sort of behaviors. And now people are starting to wonder whether, can you be addicted to Facebook? I haven't heard too much about people being addicted to Twitter, but presumably it's only a matter of time before that's considered some kind of disorder as well. But I think all these things are like on a sliding scale, aren't they? And we perhaps slide up and down if depending on how we're doing the rest of our days.
Is it accurate to say addiction, or does addiction have to have a physiological component, or perhaps is the little dopamine squirt you get from checking your Facebook enough to qualify that time spent as addictive?
I think technically that you can't really call it addiction when it's Facebook, but and especially because Facebook is a load of activities, really. It's not, you know, it has sort of social networking and it has games as well, so... You know, you can't just be just addicted to Facebook in general. But, you know, when you see some people using it, it does kind of look like that it's acting in the same way as an addiction. And people do have that sort of craving for it, and that feeling that when they're away from it, they just want to get back to it as quickly as possible. And it can damage the other aspects of their lives. And that really is the important thing with addiction. You know, if it's cutting into your everyday routines and activities that you need to get done, then it can be a problem and needs addressing.
Jeremy Dean is with us. He is a psychologist and creator of the website SciBlog. His new book is called Making Habits, Breaking Habits: Why We Do Things, Why We Don't, and How to Make Any Change Stick. Join the conversation by calling us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. New spring semester personal enrichment and professional development courses are now open and available for registration. You can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with psychologist Jeremy Dean. He's the creator of the website SciBlog and author of the book Making Habits, Breaking Habits: Why We Do Things, Why We Don't, and How to Make Any Change Stick. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. Jeremy, I was fascinated in your chapter about cultivating creative habits that you devoted so much attention to the value of constraints in spurring creativity.
Yeah, and we tend to think, don't we, that with creativity, the important thing is that you should kind of open your mind wide open to all kinds of possibilities. And what happens is that when you kind of open yourself up to all sorts of possibilities, suddenly when anything seems possible, nothing's possible. You know, it's like that thing when you sit in front of your computer and you've got to write something, and it's just got the cursor blinking back at you, and you could write anything, but you end up just going off to see what's in the fridge.
Right. And or checking Facebook.
Yeah, checking Facebook, exactly. And so what psychologists have done is they've tested people in studies of creativity to see what happens when they're given particular constraints. If you make... It should be making the task a little bit more difficult, but actually it seems to increase people's creativity. One of the examples I use in the book is of a show on TV, an improvisation show called
Whose Line Is It Anyway?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, which you have in the US, don't you?
Mm-hmm.
And this one, they take suggestions from the studio audience, And I think they're a really vital part of the show, those suggestions, because it's with those suggestions that, people can be more creative. So, yeah, it's one way, I think, of sort of getting away from habitual responses, which in some ways is what you're looking for in creativity, can be to introduce constraints.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We have Ron on the line now in Terrell. Hi, Ron.
Yes, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have always wondered and looked at many different forms of addiction, all the way from, you know, just minor, ordinary things that we do, all the way to, you know, strong addictive behaviors such as methamphetamines and alcohol, and which are highly destructive. And I've always wondered, and I don't know if there's ever been a study about it, whether or not we actually have the ability to determine that weaning somebody off of a drug or a habit versus going cold turkey actually works. And I don't know if there's any way of answering that, but I was just curious about how he feels about that and what he has seen in his life.
Thanks for your call, Ron. Jeremy, the difference between tapering off slowly and going cold turkey?
Yeah, I think that it'll probably depend on what kind of habit it is. And you're talking about quite strong and dangerous drugs there, and perhaps this idea of going cold turkey with those can be helpful, possibly, in those situations. But I think that for the vast majority of kind of regular habits, you know, relatively everyday ones, then perhaps this idea of tapering off is going to be more acceptable. And I think the reason for that is that, you know, our general everyday situations are going to cue up our habits all the time. And so it's going to be very difficult to just totally shut off a habit. So, and we'll be looking to try and replace that bad habit with a good one. And there'll be this period where the two habits, your new good one and the old bad one, will be competing with each other. And you're going to perform the bad one every now and then, and you're just hoping that the good one is going to get stronger and take over from the weaker one. So I would say for sort of everyday ones that this kind of tapering off is probably going to be the more frequent thing that people will experience.
So if we can benefit from, rather than saying, I'm going to get healthy in 2013, you know, starting with I'm going to eat fewer desserts and then moving on to I'm going to walk instead of drive to work, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
How long do we have to wait before we feel one habit has been achieved and solidified and until we can move on to the next one, sort of adding a second one or a third?
Well, oddly, I think the moment that you're ready to move on to the second one is once you don't notice the first one anymore.
Hmm.
And once it's automatic and ingrained, then you should just be doing it without really thinking about it. So that means that you're ready to go and it's time for the second one. But, you know, sometimes it's about self-awareness, I think, as well, and being mindful of what we're performing in the moment. And you should notice with a little bit of mindfulness when the habit is starting to become automatic.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Susan's on the line now in Cleburne. Hi, Susan.
Thank you, Chris. You touched on physiology a few minutes ago, and I'm wondering if the guest discredits a genetic tendency. As an alcohol, I've told our boys, if you don't play with it, you won't know your body wants it.
Hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And I think there is a genetic component with habits in general. And certainly we know that with some types of habits that there's a strong genetic component. For example, obsessive compulsive disorder. And there's certainly a genetic component with that. And I think it's with alcoholism as well, there's a genetic component. So we know that there's going to be some component to it, but obviously it's going to make a huge difference, the environment that you're in and the situations that you're in. So even though there's a genetic component towards forming a particular habit, it's going to make a massive difference, you know, what you consciously choose to do and the people that are around you and the situations that you're in.
What role do habits play in how happy or unhappy we perceive our own lives to be?
Yeah, this is one of the things about habits that can be a little bit irritating. And if you think that lots of our habits are good ones and ones that we originally got pleasure from and hopefully still do, then one of the irritating things about habits is this pleasure tends to kind of leak away over time. I mean, I'm into cycling. I really enjoy cycling. And, you know, I do notice that as I'm cycling, my mind tends to wander off to other things, and I'm not really appreciating it in quite the same way. And this seems to be the case with all our habits. We seem to sort of lose that pleasure that we once got from them with time, because partly because they're becoming unconscious and we're performing them automatically. So one of the things that you could do, which I talk about in the book, is making quite small tweaks, really, to the way that we perform our habits. So, for example, when I'm cycling, I'll try to listen to different types of music or cycle a different route going a different way or a different time of day can really help. And what it does is it kind of brings you up off autopilot. And it's about this idea of mindfulness again, that you just get more in contact with what you're doing in the moment, and then you can re-experience that and you can feel more pleasure, you know, more like you did the first time you enjoyed it.
Does that same habituation account for why, I don't know about your finances, why we all assume that we will be happy if we get rich, and then once people have achieved wealth, they don't report day-to-day feeling much happier than they did when they were middle class?
It's another irritating thing, isn't it, about you know, you think, well, if only I had 10% more income or 15% more income, then I'd be happier. And people are happier for a short period, and then they get used to it. And oddly enough, it seems to be the same is also true for countries as well as people. You know, when we see rises in standard of living in countries, for example, in the U.S., you know, you've got this huge rise in the standard of living over the last 100 years and or more. But people don't seem to be that much happier, and that's because we've got used to all these things. And it's one of the irritating things about habits in that sense, that we get used to our improved circumstances.
What do we know, Jeremy, about those miraculous individuals that we each know at least a couple of, who seem to be fully in control of all of their habits, who seem to have kicked the bad ones and taken on good ones and not to struggle the way the rest of us do?
They're very irritating people, aren't they? I'm certainly not one of those, and I don't think the vast majority of us are. But, yeah, we seem to vary quite a lot in our self-control, the amount of self-control that we have. But one thing we can say about most people is that most people do overestimate how much self-control they have. And, you know, we do this all the time, I think. So one of the things that you can do about this is to kind of pre-commit yourself. So this is when you know you're going to be weak at some point in the future, you try to make the decision now that will stop you, falling prey to this weakness. For example, if you know you've got a report to write at the weekend or some work to do, but you think, well, you're going to be sat and you're going to be, you know, playing on the games console, for example, then, you know, you can take the controller out and you can give it to a friend and say, look, don't give it back to me until next week. And, you know, so it's about kind of thinking ahead and seeing if you can sort of trick yourself in some ways into doing what you want to do.
Is there any long-term protective value to constantly working on a habit? You know, we're learning so much now about the education being a preventive factor against Alzheimer's and, sort of using your brain in novel ways. I wonder if the novelty of making a new habit or breaking a bad habit would be similarly beneficial.
I would guess that it can be. I don't think there's any research done on that yet. And it would be interesting to see what would come out of that. But I'd imagine that making these little tweaks to your routines and habits and making new habits and breaking old ones is going to be continuously kind of, you know, keeping life interesting, I think. And that's part of the challenge, isn't it, to sort of, finding new ways to re-experience the world, and especially as we get older and our habits tend to get a little bit more ingrained and we get a little bit more stuck in our ways. Certainly I've noticed that in myself over the years. It's just about breaking out a little bit. And it's not even necessarily about particularly bad habits sometimes. It just can be, these little tweaks, and we can just change our routines in relatively small ways, and it keeps yourself alive, doesn't it?
So many parents worry that if they don't set their kids up with good habits now, that sort of all is lost for them later. Is it ever too late? Is there a point at which it becomes much harder, truly, to break habits or make new habits?
I don't think there is really a point where it's too late. I think there's always hope. And for parents are obviously often worrying about their children, and I think children do pick up a lot of habits from the people that they're with, you know, their peers, their school friends, and so on. And as we move through life, these situations tend to change around us, and as the situations change, then our habits will change with them. So, I think parents do get very concerned about the way that the habits that their kids are picking up, but I think that they will change over the years, as they move into new situations and on into life. It's what we see, generally speaking, is that at these major breaking points in people's lives, for example, when they move out of home, or when they get married and move in with their partner, or when you have a baby, you see these big changes in the way people's habits operate. So, yeah.
I think if we go very quickly here, we can take Omar's question in Dallas. Hi, Omar.
Hi, how's it going?
Very well, thank you.
Love the show. I just had a quick question and a comment, just that about a correlation between purpose and long-term changing of habits. Like, basically, I'm thinking, like, myself, I've been in recovery for over 6 years, and, like, one thing for me in, like, looking long-term is, like, what is my purpose in this and also making a firm decision in changing a behavior. Like, what is, like, this correlation between, like, having a strong, like, my purpose is to be of maximum service to my fellow human being, and this habit stands in the way of that.
That's a really interesting question. What about that, Jeremy?
Yeah, that's very important. I mean, I've been talking about a lot of quite low-level, specific, sort of taking particular actions in particular situations, but it's very important to connect these up, as the caller is saying, with higher ideals, with the higher goals that you're going for. And that's really good. You do need to think about those and have that kind of connection. And it's been shown that, you know, it's really important, especially for happiness, and to have meaning in your life, and to connect your everyday habits with these higher kind of goals. So, yeah, very important indeed, I'd imagine.
Jeremy Dean is a psychologist, and he's creator of the website PsyBlog. His new book is called Making Habits, Breaking Habits, Why We Do Things, Why We Don't, and How to Make Any Change Stick. Jeremy, thank you so much for spending this hour with us.
Pleasure to be with you, Chris. Thank you for having me.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Joe Bellotti answers the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. Jeff Whittington is our senior producer. You can learn more about the show and download the podcast free at kera.org/think. We always welcome your comments, questions, and suggestions. You can email them to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.